1 Kings chapter 10 as we continue looking at Solomon's kingdom. Tonight we're going to look at prosperity beyond belief. We started describing the glory of Solomon's kingdom last week in looking at his hobbies and some of the things that he undertook in the end of chapter 9. So here tonight in 1 Kings 10, we're going to look at the Queen of Sheba and some of the great wealth of the kingdom under Solomon's rule. Now remember, we're already in the last part of Solomon's reign, or the events that are being described probably all take place in the first 25 years of his reign. So we've only got about 15 years left. That's going to occupy starting in chapter 11, but it's the downfall. As we chronicle the rise and fall of the Israelite empire under the early kings, we've hit the peak. This is it. So spoiler alert, sorry to tell you, next week things start taking a downturn under Solomon. And it's going to be a roller coaster ride for the next 500 years of Israelite history as we finish out the book of Kings, 1 Kings and 2 Kings. So 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1. Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. So, Queen of Sheba, probably a lot of your Bibles might say this is in, she's the queen of Ethiopia. That's a pretty popular traditional explanation for where she's from. Of course, Ethiopia being the southern part of Egypt. But the word is really Saba in the Hebrew and refers to the Sabian area, which is out in the desert wilderness of Arabia. So, oh, my computer locked up. Pewter. Nope. Sorry, I lost it, I think. The time stopped? It's still only 6:09. You all are going to be looking up there like, this feels like it's been going on forever, and it's still only 6:09. Okay, well, at any rate, you know what? Hang on one second. Since we got the map up there, maybe I can... There we go. All right, so right here on the screen, you can see, Ethiopia is down here south of Egypt. That's one of the traditional explanations for where the Queen of Sheba is from. But as I said, the Hebrew word is Saba. She's the Queen of Saba, which goes along with an area called the Sabians. They pop up at other points throughout the scriptural record. But it's over in this area. They were kind of a wandering, sort of nomadic, but they were known for their merchandise. They were known for trading in gold and spices and all of the things that the Queen of Sheba is bringing, the Sabians were known for. They tended to send out wandering bands of raiders at times too. But at any rate, this shows us that the fame of Solomon was not localized to just the area of the Middle East, but was spreading all over the place. Of course, we know that probably the Egyptians knew about him. And what do we know about the connection between Egypt and Solomon? He married a princess of Egypt, so the Egyptians know about him. We know that he has subjugated all of the other nations immediately around Israel. So the Amalekites down in this area have been virtually wiped out by Saul and David. They're left as roving bands of people. Edom down here has been reduced to a vassal state. Moab is bringing tribute. The Aramites up here and even the Philistines over on this side, all of these nations immediately around Israel are vassal states. They submit to the rulership of Solomon, so they might have their own kings, but their kings are subjugated to Solomon. Gene, you were going to ask? Yes. Yeah, it was. They did have caravan routes going out to Sabia. Go ahead, Eldon. Yes, you're right. I forgot about that. Thanks for bringing that one up. Yeah, so it was a band of roaming Sabians that destroyed his camels. That wasn't the one that raided his... What's that?
It was one of the things.
Yeah.
They captured
him and
off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was part of where they come up. They do come up at other points too, but at this point, they have heard of the fame of Solomon and the glory of his kingdom, at least to the point that their queen is highly impressed and wants to travel to see him. The Sabians from the Arabian Peninsula were also very well known for loving riddles. They loved to hear parables and riddles and try to figure things out. How many of you like word puzzles? Ethan's got his hand up, just loves word puzzles. So, none of you do like the crossword puzzle or anything? You don't like word puzzles? Yeah, Wanda does, yep. So riddles, one of the fun scenes in Lord of the Rings, if anybody's ever read those books, is that the main character, Bilbo Baggins, sits and has a riddle contest with a creature called Gollum, and that's how he gets the One Ring, which is a major point of the book. But they sit there and have, the only riddle I can remember from the whole thing is, it's a, what is it? I said I could remember it, and now I'm not going to be able to bring it back up, right? A box without keys, hinges, or lid, yet golden treasure inside is hid. And the answer is, go ahead. I'll let you tease on it for a while. You can think about it, okay? So anyway, the Sabians loved riddles. And it wasn't necessarily that kind of riddle. They wanted wisdom about the world. So they wanted metaphors between natural phenomenon and between life. So very much like what Jesus is giving us in the New Testament, these people loved these kind of riddles. And so difficult questions of all sorts. And so they're coming to hear Solomon's wisdom on those things. But I want you to notice what is intricately connected to Solomon's fame in verse 1. The name of the Lord. They understand there's something unique about this kingdom, and it's not just the king. That's going to come up again a little bit later as she talks to Solomon. But they understand this fame about Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, that God is the source of this. That there's something spectacular happening in this Israelitish kingdom. This isn't normal stuff that's going on here. It just couldn't be. And so when she comes to test him with hard questions, she's just sort of poking and prying and trying to figure out just how deep does this man's understanding go. And so verse 2, she came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices, very much gold, precious stones. So anytime a visiting dignitary would come, he would come with a gift, some kind of present for the person that you're visiting. And of course, we're going to see here in just a few verses, that would be expected to be reciprocated. And so Solomon is going to reciprocate that gift. But she comes with this huge caravan, probably of camels. Maybe they were Job's camels' descendants, right? And they've got some of Job's stuff with them, and they're returning it. But she comes with this huge retinue and all kinds of exotic things that probably were not normally available in Israel. Spices, gold, precious stones. But she's bringing this, and she enriches the kingdom with this. As God brings these people from all over the world into Solomon's kingdom. So when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. These are the riddles. She's asking him all these questions. What do you think about that? What do you think about this? If you remember back a few chapters, we talked about Solomon. His wisdom was applied to everything. He knew about beasts. He knew about horticulture. He knew about agriculture. He knew about architecture. This guy was extremely, extremely well-educated and with an understanding to just grasp all of the things that he applied his mind to. And that's a special gift. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably just a different translation of the same word. Yeah. Just everything she's thinking about is what she is sharing with him, all these questions she's got. And she wasn't able to stump him on anything. Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. So this section is in part answering the question that's brought up several chapters ago when Solomon asks for wisdom to rule the people of God. God says, yep, I'm going to give it to you. You're going to be the wisest guy that's ever... Not the wisest guy, right? Why is it that wise guy is so different than wise man? I mean, I know a lot of wise men, but I know a lot of wise guys, too. And they're not the same thing, are they? So he's the wisest man that's ever lived. But this is showing that God has kept this promise. God has endowed Solomon with this special understanding. This isn't something that people just normally run across. And so this fame has reached out, and she's come to see it. She wants to experience it herself. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. You ever seen something so spectacular you just couldn't really find words to describe it? Jerry, Cindy, see anything like that this last week? Just breathtaking views out there in those national parks. Some of them are absolutely gorgeous. And sometimes it is hard. You just, like, boy, I can't wrap my head around it enough to get the words out to describe what this is. Well, that's what the Queen of Sheba is experiencing here with Solomon. So she sees his wisdom. She hears him answer all of these questions. She's looking around at all of the things he's built in Jerusalem, how glorious his royal palace is, how well attired all of his servants are. We tend to think in today's terms, right? So if you picture royalty, good chance you're picturing something like Buckingham Palace, all right? So big palace, all these servants wearing their red coats with striped, you know, big funny black hat. They're not allowed to look at anything or smile. But you know, you got to back up about 4,000 years. Nah, yeah, 3,000 years in history here. The world isn't this developed. Buckingham Palace has been there for, I'm not going to say how long because I am not sure, but it's been there a long time. England has been a powerful nation for a very long time. They've had a chance to amass an awful lot of wealth. And so don't necessarily picture things like that. So when the Queen of Sheba comes in to see Solomon and she sees that all his servants are uniformed, and are arrayed splendidly, and they do have the trappings and the decorations and the golden vessels. This is an amazing thing that had not yet been seen in all of the countries of the world. Even Egypt, in its glory, never reached what Solomon was able to build during his reign. Nothing like this had ever been seen before. And so there was no more breath in her, she said. I can't even speak to this issue. So verse 6, she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it, and behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I have heard." So somehow the text messages and Facebook messages and the Twitters have not clearly communicated just how great Solomon's kingdom is. But when she gets there, she's left speechless by everything that she sees. Right? Pretty spectacular stuff. So verse 8, here's one of the great parts of this passage. "Happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom." What she's saying here is your people are just blessed beyond belief. To be able to sit here and listen to this, to be able to sit here in this sort of environment where everything is so beautiful, everything is so ornate, and on top of that, to be able to hear the wisdom with which God has blessed you. Verse 9, "Blessed be the Lord your God who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel." There she's recognizing what the source of all this is. She's recognizing where all this prosperity and all this wisdom has come from. This isn't something Solomon built up on his own. The Lord did this. God granted this to Israel. Now, we have to be careful, too, that we don't assign some New Testament concept of saving faith here. ancient world was very much like the modern world. They were quite willing to accept multiple gods at one time. And so pluralism was the rule of the day then, just as it is now. So while she's giving glory to the God of Israel for doing this, she's not necessarily saying that the God of Israel is the only God that exists, right? So there is a little bit of a distinction going on there. It's like when Nebuchadnezzar is reduced to walking like a beast, or even before that, when God saves Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges that Jehovah is a great God. He's the God Most High, but he's not saying he's the only one. He's just saying, wow, Jehovah must be stronger than all my gods that I've been worshiping. So we have to be careful in the Old Testament to not attribute what's not being said. So she is acknowledging that God's the source of this, that Jehovah, the God of Israel, is the source of these things, but she's not necessarily acknowledging that that he is the only true God, okay? So there is a little bit of a difference there. But blessed be the Lord your God who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Look at this next section. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness. This was considered like the job of the king, to execute justice and righteousness, to make sure that everything got leveled out, that all the wrongs were righted, and all of the rights were rewarded. That was the job of the king. Unfortunately, we don't think that's the job of a king anymore. We tend to look at other stuff. So he's got to manage the economy, and he's got to be the diplomat on the world stage, and all these other things. And we don't really look at our rulers as the ones executing justice anymore. But that is a big part of the biblical purpose of government, is to execute justice. Make sure wrongs get taken care of. Make sure they get righted. Right? And so she's saying, look, here's the reason she gets this part at least. Here's the reason that Israel is in the station it's in, because God loves Israel. And she can recognize that. As she looks at Israel and says, this place is amazing. Look at what you've done with this. God must love you to put you on the throne. You're so wise, you're so accomplished, you're so educated, you're so able in all of the things he's managed over the last 25 years. God must love you. And God does love Israel. Calls her the apple of his eye, right? Verse 10, then she gave the king 120 talents of gold, and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Of course, we know spices are very, very prominent in the East. That's why so many explorers tried to get over there to be able to set up a trade with the Far East via ship. And so some of the things that grow over there just don't grow in the Middle East. And so she's able to bring all these. So imagine being able to put oregano on your pizza for the first time under Solomon's kingdom. No, they didn't have pizza at that point, so that's okay. But they're able to spice all their food, and imagine what that brought. How many of you like spices? Anybody grow your own in your garden? We got a few of them, but I mean, doesn't spice just a little bit? Yeah. Doesn't spice just make food good? I mean, it can take something that's kind of ho-hum and make it, yeah. We had, last night was boys' night to cook in the Kelly house again. We do this about every other week or so because I don't want my kids to fall into the position I was in when I first got married, and my repertoire consisted of Malto meal and cereal, right? And so all the cooking fell on Kim for like, 18 years? And so I've been trying to work with the boys, teach them how to cook a little bit. And last night, we made steak gorgonzola. We had this at Olive Garden here a little while ago, but you make Alfredo noodles, right, the thick ones, and you make an Alfredo sauce, and you put that on, and you fry up some steak in the skin. Anybody getting hungry yet? Cut it into real thin slivers, and you put that on, and some sun-dried tomatoes and some gorgonzola cheese, and it's supposed to be spinach. And I sent Daniel out to get spinach, and he came back in. And he says, Dad, we don't have any spinach out there. I said, what are you talking about? We got spinach out there. I planted all kinds of spinach. So I went out with him, and lo and behold, I forgot we had used up all the spinach. So we used kale instead of spinach. Fantastic. But all the spices you put in there, you know, when you just cook steak in olive oil and garlic, oh, it's delicious. Now, steak on its own is good. Steak with some spices in it is just fantastic. Salt, pepper, a little bit of garlic on there. And now everybody's saying, he better finish up. I got to go home and eat. Right? Isn't God good, though? I mean, all of that to say, God could have made food fuel, and that's it. We have to have it to live, right? And I think that's purposeful. God gave us food because we need a 24/7 reminder that we don't live on our own. We are dependent on Him for it. Same reason I think He made us breathe. So that every 2 seconds I've got to stop and remind myself that my life doesn't come from me, it's dependent. And that's supposed to lead us to another conclusion to say, you know what, if I need bread and I need air and I need water for this body to keep on living, I must need something else to live eternally, to have eternal life. And so, because we're not so smart, we're kind of thick-headed, God flat out told us, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So God could have just made food fuel. You put it in, you burn it, you stay alive, and that's all there is to it, right? But He didn't, because He's good. Eternal life, it's just going on forever, and that's it, right? Or did He come that we might have life and that we might have it more abundantly? He illustrates that for us in this life by giving us food that's not just fuel, it's good. It's enjoyable. We get to eat it. We get to delight in it. There's nothing wrong with that. So throw some more spice on that food next time you eat it, right? It's good stuff. Well, she brings all these spices in and enriches the kingdom of Israel with these goodies, whatever they were. Chocolate chips make a great spice in lots of different things, don't they? I wouldn't put it on, I don't know, steak and chocolate. Maybe not. We put chocolate chips in just about everything. They go in cookies, they go in pancakes, they go in oatmeal. We make baked oatmeal with chocolate chips. We love our chocolate chips in the Kelly house. But. All right, she gave 120 talents of gold. I'm going to have Ethan pull up your calculator. We're going to do a little quick math here. Now, we determined last week that a talent consists of about 75 pounds of gold, right? So, Ethan, we need to multiply 75 times 16 to get the number of ounces. And then we're going to multiply that by 120. And then we're going to multiply that number by the current price of gold, which I didn't check from last week, so we're going to go with about $1,200 an ounce. See what he comes up with. How long would it take you to do that on a slide rule? Okay, so there's almost $173 million in today's currency that she brings into the kingdom of Israel. And that's just a present. Right? This is the kind of prosperity that God is bringing into the nation of Israel. Talk about blessing, right? Talk about God fulfilling His promises to Solomon. So, 100 and, what was it? 100 and? 173. And that's just the gold, yeah. I mean, spices aren't cheap, good ones. And precious stones she's bringing too, right? So, very great quantity of precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, we're not done yet. Think about how great this kingdom must have been. I mean, we're still not finished with the wealth that's there. The fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. So there's more gemstones coming in and precious wood. Now, normally you don't think of wood being precious. If Dan were here, he could talk to us a little bit. When you're working with wood, some of the wood you're talking about, if you just go with a nice little white pine, not all that expensive. But if you're talking about exotic woods like Brazilian cherry or zebra wood or dark walnut or things like that, you're talking some high-priced dollar stuff. And so this queen, this fleet doesn't just bring the financial wealth. They're bringing stuff that wasn't even accessible in Israel. And so you can imagine what this kingdom is looking like as not only money is coming in, because what good does money do you if you can't buy anything different with it? If the only thing that exists in your economy is sheep and cows, and everybody's got a whole bunch of sheep and cows, that's fantastic. Everybody's well supplied with wool and with milk. But that's it, right? But that's not what Solomon's kingdom was. He was bringing in goods from all over the world because of the people coming to visit him and because of this fleet of trading ships that he sent out to Ophir. And so they come back not just with gold and precious stones, but with exotic woods. And he's able to build with them and decorate the kingdom with this stuff. So verse 12, here's what he did with it. The king made of the almug wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house. And so this wood's obviously very, very sturdy. And so he's using it as sort of decorative covers, probably, on some of the columns and things that exist in the house of the Lord. But he's also using it, look at this, he's making instruments out of it. He makes lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. So this was a shipment of especially precious stuff. How many of you have heard of Stradivarius violins? All right, everybody's heard of Stradivarius. They think that one of the reasons Stradivarius violins are so good is because the trees that were used to make them grew during a period when the sun's sunspot cycle was at an all-time low. It's called the Maunder minimum, and I think it was in the 1450s to early 1500s. It was when the sunspot activity of our sun was the lowest it's ever been measured. Well, that brought in an extreme cold period for 75 years. Well, when the temperature is cold, trees grow densely. And so when Stradivarius was making his violins, he was harvesting wood that grew during that time. And so the wood was dense, it was strong, it had characteristics that that we just don't see in trees today. It's why we can't replicate what he did. That's why those violins are so precious. They're so unique. We can't make them anymore. So something like that's going on here with Solomon's kingdom as he's getting this supply of wood that Israel's never seen before because it doesn't grow in that area, and he's able to make these instruments out of it to beautify the worship in the temple. So now not only are they worshiping with the shofar horns and some of the Davidic instruments, but he's able to make some of these high, high quality precision instruments for the people to play. And so not only is the kingdom being enriched, but the worship in the house of the Lord is being enriched as well. And so King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba all that she desired. Remember I said there was going to be a return for her gift? So she brought a housewarming gift of $180 million or so. And everybody's saying, yeah, I'd like to invite her over to my place. Right? Keep the cookies and the gift bag and just bring on some of that gold. Well, Solomon is expected to return the favor with something of similar value, right? And so he gives her all that she desired, whatever she asked, besides what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. And we're not told exactly what it is that he gives her. Something that would have been unique to Israel that she could have taken home and showed off in her own royal palace. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. But there's that account of King Solomon's fame and the blessing of God is going out into all the world. Boy, doesn't this sound a little bit like God's promise to Abraham, through you and through all your seed will all the nations of the earth be blessed? Now we know that ultimately that's speaking about Jesus. How is God blessing the world through the son of Abraham? through Jesus. He's bringing the greatest blessings, every spiritual blessing to those who will trust him. But it's being fulfilled in a small way through Solomon here as the blessing of the Davidic kingdom is spreading out into the world. This is going to happen again, by the way. When Christ rules in Jerusalem, Israel is going to be this kind of prosperous kingdom, and the wealth of the nations is going to flow into it. During the thousand-year reign of Christ, we're going to see a return to this, but in a bigger way. Right? Verse 14, we get into account of some more of the wealth of Solomon. Now, the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Ethan, Gary's going to race you. So, 16 times 75 to get the number of ounces in a talent, times 666, times 1,200. $950,400,000. So we're closing in on right about $1 billion a year economy that Israel has. Now remember, this is 3,000 years ago. I'm not sure. $1 billion. I don't know. Politicians don't even trade in numbers so small anymore. You're talking about a huge economy for a country that occupies such a small amount of space. But this is the revenue that King Solomon is bringing in. So how in the world did he afford to build that palace and the house of the forest of Lebanon and the temple of the Lord? Because this is what God provided for him. You ever known somebody that the Lord just seemed to dump money into their lap and they used it for him? And they were sort of like a clearinghouse. So God would bring them money in through their job or whatever, and they would distribute it to different ministries and just benefit people all over the place. They were giving to the poor. They were helping odds and ends ministries. And sometimes God will just bless somebody that way because he wants to use them as a channel to distribute blessing to a whole bunch of people. It's an amazing thing to watch. And he's doing it this way with Solomon. Now, that 666 talents of gold, that almost $1 billion annual, verse 15, is besides that which came from the explorers and from the businessmen of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. So this isn't even talking about that fleet of merchant ships that he sends out. And it's not even talking about what gifts were brought to Solomon by people like the Queen of Sheba. This isn't the budgeted amount, right? This is just what we're working with on a national level. So King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. I did the calculations on this one, and I forget what it was. So a shekel, you probably have a note at the bottom of your page that says something like a shekel is about 2/5 of an ounce, right? And so, Ethan, do us some more calculations. What's 600 or times 2/5? So take 2, divide it by 5, multiply it by 600. Okay, so 240 ounces of gold in one of these large shields. Now, multiply that by 1,200 again.
288,000.
Okay, so you got a shield here worth about $288,000 of gold. How'd you like to hold that thing? Right? Ever held $300,000 in your hand? When I was a kid, we went with my dad. We were going on vacation, and we went to rent a minivan so that we could drive on this vacation. And we walk into the rental place, which was a dealership, and sitting in the foyer was a silver Lamborghini. I don't know if any of you are car aficionados, but it's kind of like a Ferrari, right? This Italian, handmade Italian car, the only silver Lamborghini ever made. And my sister, filled with excitement at the gleaming sight of this car, ran up and stuck her face right against the window, right? And, I mean, like, alarms went off and armed men came in. No. Guys came running over like, get away from the vehicle. So we pulled her back. Sticker price on this car, $180,000. So I've never been able to understand paying more for a car than you would for a house, but, you know, some people have that kind of spending money. So you're talking about a shield here, almost $300,000, this gold shield. Now, it's not solid gold, so what they would do is build the structure out of wood or like a weaving, like basket material, and then they would hammer the gold on top. So they would hammer the gold into very thin sheets until it would start sticking to the surface. And that way they could carve the wood into the shape they want, and then they use the gold to overlay it. So we're talking about an overlay. But these things must have been massive. And they would have had Solomon's emblem on them. They would have had some decorative work on them. These were spectacular things. And he's got 200 of them. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold that had 3 minas of gold in each one. And so a mina is a little smaller, about 1.25 pounds. So we're talking about 40 ounces of gold here in this one. So much smaller little shields. But these were decorative things. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Probably when he had a visitor from another country come, he would have his servants lined up holding all these shields, right? Be like parade day, and they would bring them out. And the sole purpose of them, because mind you, gold is not a very good armor in battle. It's too soft. It doesn't actually block much. So this was all purely decorative. And so he also, verse 18, the king also made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with finest gold. So here again, this would be a wooden throne, and it would have had ivory inlays all over it, and it was overlaid with gold. This thing is going to be gorgeous, beautiful thing. The throne had 6 steps, and at the back of the throne was a calf's head, and on each side of the seat were armrests, and 2 lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, one on each end of a step on the 6 steps. The like of it was never made in any kingdom. So you have this throne that's got 6 steps going on to it, and there's lions on each step, so that as you go up, you're facing these lions. It would have been a magnificent sight to behold. So the whole point of all this was to instill some sense of awe and fear as you approach the king of Israel. He's too great. You know, we shouldn't be approaching him. That's sort of the picture that's going on here. All of King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were silver. I love this part. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. I mean, can you imagine living in an economy where people are looking down their noses at silver? They're silver snobs. You know, silver, if that's all you can afford, I suppose that's okay. Right? But Solomon, everything he owns is made out of gold. Sounds like King Midas. Everything he touched became gold, right? But this is Solomon. This is God's blessing on him. The king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. And once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. So Don and Alicia aren't here tonight, but they'd have been happy about this, bringing those peacocks back, right? If you ever want a peacock feather, I'm sure you just have to ask. They have plenty of them, but those are pretty things too. So you've got all this exotic stuff flowing in for the Israeli National Zoo with apes and peacocks, but all this gold, and there's so much silver flowing into the land that it's basically become worthless. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it in payment because there's so much of it laying around. Right? Well, that's how we're going to feel about cash dollars here pretty soon, right? There's going to be so much of it, it's not going to be worth anything. And King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses and mules, so much year by year. This is why this kingdom is something so glorious, because the wealth of the nations is just flowing into this little kingdom in the Mideast, because of God's blessing upon Solomon. One last item that shows the blessing of the kingdom down in verse 26. Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. Now this is an interesting statement because it on the one hand shows the blessing of God in just how mighty Solomon had become, that he could maintain a standing army of chariots. Because these things were expensive. You got chariots? What pulls a chariot? Horses. What do you got to do with horses? Feed them and muck out their stalls. So not only are we talking about chariots here, but we're talking about the maintenance shops. We're talking about the horse stalls that he would need. We're talking about the people that would make, you know, repair the wheels. All of the things that go into the care of a chariot. It's not just about the chariot, but it shows the wealth of the kingdom in what he's able to maintain here. He made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and he made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew, and the king's traders received them from Kew at a price. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. And so through the king's traders they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. So Solomon is using the kingdom of Israel as sort of a central place to do trading. He's importing chariots, he's importing horses, and he's selling them to all the nations around. This is the glory that God has brought to this kingdom. And up to this point, it is magnificent. And the hope for us, folks, is that this glory is going to be surpassed when Christ rules, when he establishes his kingdom, because the scriptures tell us prophetically that the wealth of the nations is going to flow into Israel once again. Israel is going to be the central country in the world another time. And we're not in it for the gold and the silver. At least I hope you're not, right? We're in it for the glory of the king. And just as the people were flocking from all over the world to see Solomon and his wisdom, people are going to be flocking to Jerusalem to see the Lord Jesus, to see his wisdom, to see the glory of his kingdom. And that's going to be us. We're going to be there because he's promised that we're going to rule and reign with him. Any questions?